I'm Eddie Merckx. You listen to the Bicycle Show on Resonance 104.4 FM.
Jack Thurston. Welcome to this week's edition of The Bike Show. And in case you hadn't noticed it, summer's here. And with summer comes the Tour de France. And I'll be the first to admit that radio is perhaps not the best medium for following the Tour de France. Originally, of course, it was the written word in the newspaper that began the race. But since the 1950s, TV has been where it's at. On this week's show, I'm going to be talking with Ned Bolting, a member of the ITV team which covers the Tour de France on the television. Ned has written a book, which is a very funny book, called How I Won the Yellow Jumper, an account of his 10 years covering the Tour de France. And the title is an allusion to the fact that Ned, a football man, was a complete novice when it came to reporting on cycling back in 2003.
I really didn't know anything. I was only dimly aware, quite genuinely, that it was a team sport. The only rider I'd heard of was Lance Armstrong, but I kind of knew vaguely about the cancer story. I didn't understand at all that you don't just win it on your own. You don't just sort of get hop on your bike and ride faster than anyone else. You know, the whole idea that you have teammates working for you. The very notion, I mean, the very essential building block of cycling that you have to understand if you're going to even have a dimmest notion of the sport, that pushing still air to one side requires effort, and that if you let someone else do that for you, you're slipstreaming them, da-da-da-da. I didn't understand, and it actually took me years to kind of... because you can't see it on the telly. So it took me years to even grapple with that conception of teamwork and how the peloton works as a fluid unit, and what when they talk about the elastic braking. So the very basic essence of the sport was a mystery to me in 2003, and I have to confess, remained a mystery for probably too long. You know, I kind of get it now, I think, a decade on, the best part of a decade on, but boy, does it take some understanding.
So what were ITV thinking?
ITV dumbing down? Is that what you're suggesting?
No. Why did they come to you? Yeah, what did you think of that? Did you think, no way, I'm going to get into this world of nerds, and I'm a football guy?
Yeah, there was a bit of that. I did kind of look, it was a job, and ITV acquired the rights, and they know, I think, from my work on football and to a certain extent rugby, that I had a kind of certain broadcasting style, and I guess in the backs of their minds, they quite wanted to apply that. But, that's implying that they had some sort of joined-up thinking about this. I don't think they did. It was just like, quick, they need a reporter. Here's one. Go and do it. And I thought, yeah. But I did, in the back of my mind, I thought, this will be quite nice, won't it? This will be, you know, I'll be strolling around Norman churchyards, and, you know, it'll be light, fruity wines and cheese, and kind of, it'll be a little saunter through the French countryside, won't it? I was completely wrong. It's nothing like that.
So what is it like?
It's horrible. I mean, good horror. I mean, crap, yeah, nasty, brilliantly horrible. Yeah, it's all these kind of... But it's not quaint. That's one thing it isn't, right? It's garish, it's brash, it's noisy. It's got a carbon footprint the size of flipping Norway. You know, it's a disgusting event in lots of ways. It consumes the French countryside. It doesn't relish or enjoy or respect the French countryside. It tramples all over it. It leaves it in bits. It belches out diesel wherever it goes. It stinks. It makes noise pollution. It disrupts people's lives. But God, it's brilliant. I mean, you know, what is there not to love apart from almost everything? You know, as you can see, I'm still struggling with a very strong feelings of ambivalence towards the event, because ultimately it's boring as well. I'm going to spend a lot of the Tour de France in motorway service stations and on you know, huge tailbacks on the Autoroute du Soleil or whatever it's called.
So let's talk about the ITV team and what it takes to get you all in front of the camera.
Yeah.
We all know about you and Gary and Chris, and then there's Phil and Paul in the commentary box. Mm. But there's presumably a big support team as well, and then all the cameramen and sound men.
Yeah, you'd have thought it'd be big. It's not actually. It's just kind of it's as small as you can possibly get away with and still broadcast television. I mean, you know, the Americans, even in these post Armstrong years where interest has waned a bit in the States, I mean, they rock up with fleet of vehicles and about 100 personnel. The Germans, even though they despise the sport, you know, because they think it's all full of dopers, and you know, anyway, Jan Ulrich hasn't won it for years and years. They have 80 vehicles, you know, in their television production team. We've got our truck and then three cars. That's it, and we all pile into them. You know, it's like a dysfunctional family holiday with Chris Boardman as the dad.
You're the guy who has to go up to the racers after the stage and get their immediate reactions. On the surface, that sounds like a great job. You're meeting the stars. It's kind of every fan's dream. But the way it comes over in the book, it's a hell job. You're stalking them, basically, and they don't want to talk to you, and you've got to get something out of them.
Yeah, I mean, it is... Look, I mean, we're doing this interview in a lovely park in London, and as soon as I'm finished here, I'm going off to do a sit-down interview with Mark Cavendish. We're a few days out from the Tour de France now. And there are two different aspects to my job. One is that you know, I do get access to these guys in a kind of considered non-race environment, and that's a great honour and a privilege, and that I do get a great kick out of, even though it's a challenge in its own different way. And the sticking the microphone in the face of a rider who's just completed a stage, occasionally that can be exhilarating as well. You know, you like to celebrate success with them. It's a wonderful privilege to be able to be the first person on the scene to elicit that kind of fresh response when they've just achieved something that they've dreamed of all their lives. But, you know, there can only be one winner on any given day. And by and large, the Tour de France is a story for everybody else of frustration, disappointment and misfortune. And you know, that all has to come across as well. And so, yeah, look, cyclists are very grown-up sportsmen. They understand the rapacious appetite of broadcast media for the instant, sweaty, heroic reaction. They don't like it, you know. So I get my head bitten off, quite rightly, sometimes. And I smart a little bit from it, because you like to think that, you know, on a human level, they quite like you as a person. You know, that may or may not be the case, but professionally, in that moment, they loathe you, you know, and they'll let that be known, and they'll, you know. So it took a while for me to realise that actually I'm just, my job, and I am paid to be there, is just to be a lightning conductor, you know, because those fresh moments where a rider, through his kind of short temper perhaps, or his intolerance of a question, reveals the depths of his frustration, those are the ones that stick in the memories of the viewers. That's when the race comes to life in terms of the personalities. It's in those moments of anger, actually, that you see the real effort. You see the scale of the adventure, you know? And that's what I'm there for, to get that. And it's not always comfortable.
And is it quite a scrum with the other reporters? And do you have to be ruthless in getting to your man?
Yeah, it is funny. I mean, it is a massive scrum. It's like, you know, I work in football where everything's quite controlled, and actually, you know, you can't just pile on top of a footballer. But you can in cycling. You just hurl yourselves at them, and you're surrounded by this mass of, you know, camera crews and radio crews from France and the rest of the world. That's the thing. It's a global event. It's like the Olympic Games every day, you know. And sometimes the focus of everybody is on one poor little bugger with his bike, you know. And we'll just descend on them. But the funny little codes of honour exist within the press pack, and you know, occasionally someone will come in and just disrespect the codes of honour, and that's when it all kicks off amongst us. And then sometimes, when I recount in the book, sometimes it just breaks for you. I remember on my first tour, Jakob Pihl, who rode for Team CSC at the time, yeah, decent enough rider, but a ruler, really, no one, you know, ended up winning one of those sleepy stages in between the Alps and the Pyrenees when they just let the brake get away, and he ran out a win. The actual main field with Armstrong and Ulrich and the rest of them was a long way back down the road. So Pihl arrived, and he was frankly the only show in town. And so we all descended on Jakob Pihl, but he happened to stop, come over the finish line and stop right in front of me. Me. He'd single out me, the gods, you know. So he just stopped there and collapsed. And within a split second, there were hundreds of microphones in his face. And because he'd stopped in front of me, everybody held off with their questions until I'd had my turn, you know? So it was they kind of all, mind you, I think in retrospect, it's because no one actually had a question for Jakob. And I certainly didn't. I couldn't think what the hell to ask him. So rather lamely, I just said, Jakob, you won. Yeah, I still do that kind of thing, actually. I'm not sure I've really nailed that. I don't know what the first question should be sometimes. Because all it is actually, Jakob, Lance, Mark, Bradley, say something into this microphone now. You know, that's all you want.
And did it take you a while to learn the sport and get the respect and the acknowledgement of your peers who are cycling journalists who've been around for ages? Did you get any resentment from them, or did they just go, well, you know, here's Ned, he seems like a nice guy, let him get on with his business, or people, you know, what's he doing here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think by and large, cycling journalists and cycling journalism has been very kind to me. I think this is probably because they recognise a point of difference. You know, I don't think that many people think I'm an immediate threat to them. You know, I mean, the writing that cycling produces, Daniel Freeb, William Fotheringham, you know, their books on Merckx, Richard Moore, the kind of stuff that gets written, Matt Seaton stuff, is first class, isn't it? Richard Williams writes very well about cycling now. He's, you know, a relative newbie as well, but the quality of the writing is there for people who really want to understand the race and the riders. And I don't think I impinge on their fields too much. And I think that there's an acknowledgement that I occupy a slightly different space in the broadcasting media landscape. And I think people are happy, by and large, to let me get on with it. But that's what they say to my face. What they say behind my back may be something completely different, Jack.
So what's your space?
I don't know. It's kind of, in football, they call it in the hole. No one knows what it means, but it's just behind the strikers. So, you know, I don't know. What am I there for? I think probably in terms of the way I write, which I increasingly enjoy, and in terms of the work I do on the telly, I think I'm probably there to be the viewer's advocate, you know, to be the guy that you sitting on the couch, you know, the big you would be if you were me, if you see what I mean, if that makes sense. If you were out there with a microphone, you'd probably be a bit like that. Unless you're really immersed in the sport, you'd approach it with the same degree of awe, amusement, and bewilderment that I do. And I think I like to think that people have identified with that to some extent.
Because you do have to bring a complex and difficult sport that's steeped in history to an average viewer. And that's quite a challenge, just without losing and simplifying to a point where you're oversimplifying.
Well, that's the constant balancing act we all have to tread on particularly the ITV show, as opposed to, you know, Eurosport, I guess, Dave Harmon, etc., would, you know, if Dave was sat here and we were talking, I guess he would probably agree that, you know, they're kind of talking to the converted, in a sense. So it's a subscription channel. You have to be into your cycling to want to view it. But we're trying to draw in the masses a little bit. But you don't want to insult people's intelligence. You don't want to dumb it down to the point that you lose the great number of viewers who love the sport and know a lot about the sport, far more than I do, who watch it day in, day out. So, yeah, every time we talk about the rules or even the basics, you know, sometimes we have to remind people what the jerseys are. You know, we have to question, are we doing the right thing here? Are we just going to irritate more people than we're appealing to? So it's a constantly changing equation.
So your time covering the Tour de France since 2003 has coincided with the current bicycle boom, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's all down to me. I mean, it's just been the most extraordinary confluence of circumstances that have all come together. And, you know, I mean, my close colleague Chris Boardman has been a beneficiary of that and a driver of it as well. You know, Chris, when he finished racing, was approached on numerous occasions by various people wanting to build bike frames and bikes with his name on, and he held off, and being a completely OCD control freak, he waited for the right moments to bring his bikes to the market. And he designs them all, by the way. He's got a real hand in how they... And he took this brave step of producing very high-quality bikes, but selling them through Halfords. No, nobody's into their bikes would ever go and buy a bike from Halfords. My God, you know, there's this great sniffiness about Halfords. But Chris, you know, whenever it was in 2004 when he first started, knew what was coming. He could see it. And he went, no, actually, there's going to be a whole new generation of bike riders and people into the sport, both as viewers of the elite end of the sport and as willing participants and commuters who are going to be buying a bike for the first time in their adult lives. And they're not going to know that Halfords is a, inverted commas, bad place to go. They're just going to think, where do I get a bike? Oh, I know what, I'll go to Halfords. And they're going to walk into Halfords and they're going to see a bike with Chris Boardman's name on it. Go, hang on, didn't he win something in Barcelona? Ka-ching. You know? And so Chris's bikes have been flying off the racks, and fair play to him, you know. But so what Chris has done is really, he's surfed this wave. Yeah, it's well documented, isn't it? Beijing absolutely kick-started the whole thing, I think, or really gave it that kind of, it was like pouring petrol on the fire, wasn't it, what happened in Beijing. But I think since Beijing, I think last year was absolutely critical in the development of the sport with what Mark Cavendish did and the recognition that got flabbergasted me. I mean, you know, within the space of a year, he'd gone from someone people had vaguely heard of, who were general sports fans, to, of course it's Mark Cavendish, BBC Sports Personality of the Year, A-lister.
As well as the sport, people are riding bikes to get around. Have you always ridden a bike to get around?
No, but I mean, I did as a kid, like we all did, and then I stopped, like we all did, probably, except you, Jack. But so I'm a classic mammal in that respect. I mean, I couldn't be more stereotypical. But my motive for getting back onto it was the 2003 Tour de France. I spent a month watching people ride bicycles, came back home, wanted a bicycle. You know, now I've got three. what pleasure. I mean, what a pleasure it is, particularly in London. I mean, that's what London does it for me. I mean, London's this big city, and getting around this town on a bike is thrilling. It's easy, it's quick, it's just everything. It just opens the soul. I mean, it's without getting... I've got poetical about it already, but it's just fantastic, you know. Although, it has its drawbacks. I've just come from doing a television interview for a documentary that's being made, where I had to sit down and look smart and presentable. But, of course, I arrived just dripping in sweat, with great big sweat stains all down my shirt here. And we all had to wait until the kind of my shirt had dried, you know. So that's par for the course. But,
I mean, there are people who say that there isn't actually a real link between sport, cycling, the Olympics, the Tour de France, and everyday cycling.
Nonsense. That's rubbish, isn't it? But you only need to hammer up and down the old Kent Road at kind of 8:30 in the morning, and mate, you're in a peloton, aren't you, of sort of fat middle-aged men on specialised carbon fibre bikes who think that they are riding the Tour de France.
But we're still at only 2% of journeys made by bicycle, slightly higher in London, and yeah, the character of cycling in this country is kind of different from how it is in the cycling countries of Denmark and the Netherlands.
Yeah, but we have to start somewhere, don't we? I mean, we have a totally different culture, you're right, and this crazy thing that particularly in London and the southeast you see of people commuting to work on carbon fiber road bikes with clipped shoes and all the gear, and then changing at work. You wouldn't get that in Holland or Copenhagen or Berlin, where the bike is just, of course I ride. I mean, why wouldn't I? And they ride sort of slow and comfortable and cumbersome bikes, you know. So, but we have to start somewhere, don't we? And if that's the route we're taking to get people on bikes or to rediscover the joy of cycling, then, you know, it's part of the picture, isn't it?
Because, I mean, that's part of Sky's kind of master plan to get people riding bikes. But people have said, well, you know, the congestion charge and the July the 7th bombings, you know, those actually had a bigger impact on people cycling in London than Bradley Wiggins winning a pursuit title.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jack, you're obviously more well-versed in the statistics than I am, but I mean, I can only go from my experience, and you're right, but it takes all sorts, doesn't it? I mean, just this morning I went and got my hair cut at the local Turkish barber, who I've known for years. One of those relationships where you don't know the guy's name and he doesn't know mine, but it's way too late to ask each other our names, you know. So it's all right, mate. And he saw me. I rode down to the barber shop, like I always do, locked my bike up outside his barber shop, and he goes, I walked in and he said, mate, you would be so proud of me. So proud of me. And I went, what? Why? He goes, I went out and bought a bike yesterday because I drive in from Sydenham up to Ladywell, where I live. It takes me 45 minutes. It took me 45 minutes. I went and bought a bike yesterday. It took me 10. Like that. And he's absolutely grinning from ear to ear. And I think it was kind of partly that he saw me always riding down to his barbershop and chaining my bike up all through the winter. And, you know, and he's just kind of, somewhere it's lodged in the back of his mind that that's a thing you can do. And as soon as you take that first step, albeit on a beautiful sunny morning like that, I think he's hooked. I would be surprised if he doesn't just do that now for the rest, you know. So it's like those chainmail letters that go out. You know, it's a pyramid thing. Okay, it's 2% now, but it was 1%, yeah, not so long ago. And 1% to 2% might seem like very little, but it's a hell of a step, isn't it? And possibly the next step from 2 to 4 might be less of a step, and 4 to 8 might just happen naturally. Do you see where I'm getting at? You know, you've got to get... It's that critical mass argument, isn't it? I think we're on our way.
So let's get back to the tour. And in the book, you talk about these tiny, fragmented moments of conversation that you have with the riders. Yeah. And then you read in quite a lot to it. You're reading between the lines. Yeah. And then you're thinking about how much of that reading between the lines you can bring to the broadcast. And the example that comes through very clearly in the book is the Floyd Landis after his great escape on stage 17. And you had a very strange encounter with him.
That was the day he, in inverted commas, won the Tour de France. And, of course, he'd thrown it away the day before, hadn't he, where he'd cracked in the mountains. And that was the narrative of the story. And I saw him twice that day. Once at his hotel in the morning, where, heck, by a bizarre coincidence, his team, Phonak, was sharing the same hotel as Questepagna, which was the team of Oscar Pereiro, who was now in the yellow jersey. And everybody was there to get a picture of Oscar Pereiro and grab a quick word with him, because he was the story of the day. I thought, no, I'm more interested in Landis. So I kind of doorstepped him. I wanted to talk to the guy who tossed away the Tour de France, you know. And he stepped out of his hotel straight into my path, and I went, Floyd. And instantly, and I'm not, I honestly don't think this is hindsight, but I thought something's up with this guy. He was sweating, his eyes were a little bit weird. He was even more jittery than he usually is. And I said, Floyd, what's the plan? He goes, I'm going to attack. Right, whatever. Thought nothing more of it and put my tape away and started driving towards the finish line. And as only when I got to the finish line saw live television pictures of what was happening out on the course that I realised he had attacked, and that nobody was seemed either capable or willing to chase him down. And of course, you know, he rode out that epic doped win that day. And then the very telling thing was that he didn't do any interviews afterwards, except one. And again, I was just in the right place at the right time. I happened to be lurking around outside the anti-doping caravan, and I just bumped into him after he came down the steps, and he'd just given his kind of radioactive sample that was about to detonate and ruin his life forever. And I guess he knew. He must have known the risk he'd just undergone. And he kind of stopped and very grudgingly gave me a very monosyllabic answer about, I put it to you, you've just won the Tour de France, essentially. You've just... That's one of the greatest comebacks in the history of the sport, you know that? And he goes, well, you know, and he kind of cut me short. He gave a very low-key answer about, I can't even remember what it was now, but it was telling that he didn't want to reflect on his triumph at all. And I remember walking, I was still quite new to the sport, it was only my third tour, and walking around talking to other journalists about that, Paul Sherwin being one of them, and saying, was that, have I just misread that situation, or was that all horribly suspicious? And so it proved. Sometimes it's so obvious that you can't believe it. You know, it's so in your face. Stefan Schumacher in the time trial in 2008. So obvious that everybody kind of skirts around it. And sometimes cycling is so naive and so gauche in so many ways that Vinokourov, 2007, you know? Stuff like that, when it happens, you've got to go, no, I don't believe that. You've got to do that, because otherwise you look a fool when 2 weeks after the Tour de France has finished, they released a positive blood test and you weren't there to ask the right questions at the right time.
And does that approach put you in a minority, do you think, of cycling reporters?
I think it probably does, but I mean, I don't want you to feel like I'm blowing my own trumpet here, but the approach we've taken, it's not me really, it's us on the... This is the approach we take. I mean, Gary Imlach is a very sceptical journalist. You know, he's... Blimey, some of the stuff he's written about Lance Armstrong through the years and broadcast, I don't know how it got through compliance, frankly. You know, legally, he's trodden a very close line with Lance, and Gary's always on the lookout. And I think we do, as a programme, not want to pull the wool over people's eyes. And more than that, we're quite aggressive, because it's our duty.
Your description of the Floyd Landis stage and victory and then subsequent dethroning suggests that he just did that doping the night before, he'd had a bad day, and to give himself a boost. But isn't there another argument that says actually doping is central to the whole preparation for the Tour de France, and it's not like, oh, I have a bad day, I'll go and do some doping. It's part of their whole preparation. You know, he had maybe been more successful at covering it up. Evidently, in subsequent confessions that he's made, he said, you know, he's doped all the way through and hasn't been positive, and it's not like, oh, I had a bad day, I better resort to the doping cabinet tonight.
No, although I think I'm right in saying that, subsequently he's admitted that that is what he did. I think I'm right in saying that. I'd better put an allegedly here in some ways. No, to hell with it. It's only Floyd Landis. I think he said that he did take a blood transfusion that night in the hotel that I've just described, you know, in the same hotel as...
But he was positive for testosterone.
Yeah, but it was... which is a recovery drug that's used. You know, where does the blood come from? Well, it's blood that he's taken previously before the Tour de France and stored. So the testosterone was being used.
So he's doped himself with doped blood.
Correct.
Double doping.
Double dip doping, sherbet dib dab doping. I've probably just libeled it. That's probably wildly inaccurate, but that's my understanding of it, Jack. And, God, yeah, listen, that whole thing about isn't doping just there anyway, invisibly in their training. None of us know, do we?
There seem to be two schools of journalists broadly, and not wanting to simplify too much, but those that say it's always been there, it's inevitable, get over it. And those that say it's toxic, it's going to destroy the sport, no one's going to want to pay for the sport to happen. And you seem to be in the second camp. Is that because you're new to cycling, or is that just Ned Bolting?
I'd like to think that you don't have to be in one camp or the other. I mean, I don't want to sound like a fence sitter here, but I think that you can have a twin approach. You know, you can listen. There are two things, right? One is watching a live bike race on telly, okay? Watch it, thrill to it, enjoy the spectacle, get out of your seat, shout abuse. You know, that's a thing. And forget about what the background there might be. When that bike race is consigned to history, the minute they pass the finish line, then you can start asking a whole bunch of other different questions, okay? So what I'm trying to say is, weirdly, and despite it all, and perhaps counterintuitively, this the whole doping cloud hasn't down the years, should do, but it hasn't affected my enjoyment of the live spectacle. Because, hell, that's a story. Anyway... Landis, and you know, that was, don't tell me you didn't enjoy watching that, it was astonishing. Then ask the questions, right? So, toxic, yeah, of course it's toxic, but this kind of, I know you're taking this ultra-moral position where everything's bent, turn your back on the sport. I think that's doing a huge disservice to the, what I believe, perhaps erroneously, to be the clean majority of riders in the peloton. And an increasing number of clean riders year on year. Look at the average speeds, they're getting slower. Look at the ways in which they're winning, they're less impressive. The frailties are there to a greater extent than they used to be. Do we just turn our back on all that? Or do we try and be part of the move forward? And to be part of the move forward, you do your job. And your job is where you've got a sniff of it and a good suspicion of it, you go after it like we did with Rasmussen. You know, in 2007, we knew what was going on there, and we pushed and pushed and pushed until, partly down to our pressure, Rabobank, the bank, not the team, the actual bank, rang up the team manager there and said, get him off, he's embarrassing us. And he was embarrassing us because day after day we hounded him.
But in the case of Rabobank, we now are learning that it wasn't just the bad apple in the barrel. It was a systematic doping process, and it wasn't just about getting rid of the Rasmussen, the Schumacher, the Rico, that this is something that is in the teams, that is in the blood of the sport.
What are you supposed to do? Act on no information? You know, you can't. It's very hard to act on no information, but where you do have some information, then exploit that.
But don't you think it's too easy to blame the rider, the rider's gone, the problem's solved?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I know where you're getting at. You're talking about, let's look to the that fading generation of team managers who are sit behind the riders and are pulling the strings to a certain extent and breeding that culture. I think you're right, and I think that even Sky, with some of the appointments they've made over recent years, need to have a bit of a think about who they've employed and what their individual backgrounds might be.
Although, having said that, it's been so deeply ingrained in the sport through the 80s and 90s and before, if you go for everybody who's clean, you're going to have Ned Bolting running every team. You know, not any disrespect to you as someone who's come new to the sport, but they don't want to do that because they don't want to have people who haven't got that experience that is ultimately necessary when you're running a professional cycling team. So they're in a sort of difficult position.
Each case on its merits. You know, Rhys is an interesting one, isn't he? Where do you go with Bjarne Rhys? You know, he's one of those guys. I just, one day I'll feel one thing and the next day I'll feel another thing about him, because there is something quite brilliant about him as well as thoroughly bent. You know, those two sit side by side. There's other guys like Mauro Ginetti. You know, my God, you remember him? Swiss rider. He was in charge, but I'm going to put that in huge inverted commas, of that ridiculous Sonia Duval team of 2000 and whenever it was. Who, you know, Rico et al. Yeah. You know, so you know, each case on its merits, each case push. You know, but what needs to open up more in cycling is I've only had these kind of conversations about who's done what with riders after the event. I've only spoken Roger Hammond. Yeah, Roger stopped riding now. Sit down and talk to Roger about who's done what in his experience and knowledge. You know, and he's full of nuggets and bits and pieces, most of which can't broadcast on here. But if we could only have those informal conversations more often between the clean guys in the peloton, the good guys, if you like, you know, the guys who you can settle a stall by, you know, they don't need any longer, I don't think, or I'd like to think, to be so afraid that they can't just brief us occasionally when they've heard something. You know, it is all grist to the mill.
So we have the US Anti-Doping Agency case against Lance Armstrong, Johan Bruneel et al. Where do you see that going? Is that something that the Tour de France and cycling can recover from?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm bored, so I can just, you know, forget him. I'm so over it. I was quite disappointed by Jeff Nowitzki's federal investigation collapsing for corporate fraud. I mean, I thought that was very interesting. The USADA think, oh, it'll be what it'll be. It'll drag on for months. He'll counter-appeal and... You know, and frankly, say he loses ultimately his 7 titles, what do you do with them? Chuck them in a bin? Who do you give second place to? Do you know what? I don't care. They should almost make those Armstrong years null and void now. You know, there was no winner from 1999 to 2005 like that, you know. I've completely lost interest in Lance Armstrong. A few years ago, if you'd asked me the question, I would have been maybe one of those who would have gone, cycling can't recover from this. But maybe it's a British thing, because we've got carried away with what's going on with our British riders. We've got bigger fish to fry than Lance flipping Armstrong, haven't we now? I mean, you know, whatever about him. Let's move on.
So how about Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin? Yeah. Can they recover from this?
Well, the thing you have to understand about Phil and Paul is they work fundamentally for the American network. I'm not breaking any news there. I think if you've been a student of the coverage, you'll have realised that. They're paid by us for their services. They're also paid much more substantially by the American network, so they call the tune. And look, it's been the style of both OLN, the Outdoor Life Network, which was dubbed the Only Lance Network, and their successor Versus, to ask no questions at all and to celebrate only the epic. And Phil and Paul have bought into that, as well as financially, to a certain extent, they are involved in that American scene. I'll just leave it at that in terms of that. I don't want to condemn them too much for that, but it does figure in their commentary from time to time. I will say this. Phil Liggett calls the last kilometre of a race by a country mile better than anybody else out there, with the possible exception of radio's Simon Brotherton, who's very good as well. But Phil on television does it 100 times better than anybody else. And no disrespect to Dave Harmon, if you're listening to this, Dave, you've got other great qualities, but Phil can do that changing of register. You know, he's pretty even though he's 120, he's pretty damn good at spotting a rider still. But he can do the excitement thing, which ain't easy.
And it's difficult for them because they've just got the TV in front of them, like we have.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. They're looking at the same pictures. They might catch a fleeting glimpse because they are actually physically on the finish line, but that's no good to them. They'll stand up for the last 10 yards and see Cavendish raise his arms, but they won't see anything other than that you haven't seen on the telly. So just you try turning them off one day and giving it a go yourselves. You know, impossible. But going back to that, you know, the only information is what you see on the telly. That's bike racing, isn't it? There is no stadium. You know, you can't sit in the stands and watch it all unfold. And quite often when I'm on the finish line, just 100 yards the other side of where they're rushing towards me, I don't have a television monitor. I'm about to go live with an interview, you know, back home to a million people who are better informed than me because they've seen it all on the telly. I haven't even seen it. Sometimes I don't even know who's won. I'm waiting to be told through a sort of crackly radio talkback unit who's actually won, and then I'll go chasing after him. Don't know how they've won. Don't know who they came in second or third. You know, I'll find all that stuff out later. So the least well-informed person on the planet who's interested in cycling that day is also simultaneously the guy who's right in the hot seat. It doesn't make any sense, but I mean, that's just one of many ways in which the Tour de France doesn't make any sense.
So let's turn to Team Sky. You said that the only Lance Network and Versus were great cheerleaders for Lance Armstrong's teams. Is it the same for you guys in Sky?
I'm not going to say yes, am I? Of course we're going to... You know, there is a serious danger if you over Sky your Sky pudding that you're going to alienate people in this country who love the sport, have loved the sport for much longer than Dave Brailsford with his shiny scalp has been around, you know. For a lot of people, this is a beautiful continental experience with strangely named Italians and odd little Basque climbers and people who can't speak English. Heaven help us, you know. So that's still there, even with this great wave of anglicisation and isnism. That's still at the heart of the sport, and I think we rip that up and throw that away at our peril because that's what it's built on. So it's going to be tricky because... You do want... Look, they're not, it's not like they've sent some sort of no-hope British team to the start that we've got to kind of contrive to celebrate or take an undue or artificial interest in. They've got the flipping world road race champion who's there as an encumbrance to the 5-4... He's 5-4 favourite to win the Tour de France. This is a story, right, in anyone's books. Not only that, but actually, even if you took those two out and looked at the other roster of riders, they're implausibly strong now, you know, with the addition of Richie Porte, the potential of Chris Froome, the still growing potential of Eduard Bossenhagen. You could go on and on. These guys are serious bike riders in their own respect, and they're gonna boss it, I think. I don't think we'd be making it up to get quite involved in that story.
And Wiggins, quite a transformation over the years to where he is now. It's impressive stuff, isn't it?
In the modern era, it's almost unparalleled, isn't it, to redefine yourself like that. I mean, riders have done it, riders have tried. Very few have succeeded to the extent... Let's just jump forward 3 weeks and say he wins it, 4 weeks. Three Olympic gold medals on the track as a pursuiter, and then a Tour de France. No one's done that. I mean, that's physiologically shouldn't happen, should it really? I'm scratching my head physically here and metaphorically because I thought in 2009 there was no way he would ever develop beyond that, and 2010 simply confirmed that in my own mind when he finished 24th or 27th or whatever he did. So to go again, that's what's really impressed me, to go again, having really disappointed himself in 2010, and to go again and harder and better and look at the season he's had, you know, three stage races, and go back even into last season, the last... stage race, you know, the stage race he rode was the Vuelta, finished on the podium. Third place to Chris Froome, by the way. The best placed British rider on a Grand Tour ever. It's kind of perfection. You know, his form is perfection. What can you say? It might be dull to watch, you know, for those of us who aren't involved in the particularities of his career. I think it'll bore the French. It'll disappoint the Belgians, and the Italians will completely ignore it. But, you know, we'll celebrate it.
And how has he got so much better? Is it just a matter of losing weight and retaining the same power, putting the handlebars down a bit further, getting a smaller bike, being more aero?
I think he's kind of done all that already. I mean, obviously the weight loss thing is an ongoing story that he's always going to figure. But technically, you know, those who know much more about it than I do have always said that Wiggins rides like no other. You know, his pedal stroke is beautiful, his position on the bike is exceptional, stillness when he's time trialing, you know, how low he gets is just exemplary, and his ability to portion out his effort is, you know, he's got an instinct for it. He races well, he understands how far and how hard he can go, he doesn't put himself into the red, all that. But what Wiggins is very good at, and what he's getting increasingly good at actually, is assembling the right people around him. And so earlier on in his career, it was Chris Boardman who had a very formative influence on him, amongst a whole bunch of others as well. But now, and recently, and over the last couple of years, it's been Shane Sutton for the kick up the arse and the reality checks, and Tim Kerrison, who's this Aussie swimming coach who's come from the Australian swimming program and Dave Brailsford has brought in, has come into the sport with a kind of new take on it, because he's questioned it from the grassroots up. You know, this is why we now see Bradley Wiggins warming down on rollers, which is something no cyclist has ever done. And Tim Kerrison's gone, well, hang on, that happens in every other sport. There's a warm down effort. Why do you guys just fall off your bikes and then sit on a coach? You know,
because there are journalists who want to talk to you.
Yeah,
life difficult for you, isn't it?
It will. I was just thinking about that very thing this morning. I'm going to have to wait while he has a towel over his head and does his warm down interminably. But if it gets him the win, fair enough. But it's kind of obvious now that he's doing it. It's kind of obvious. But cycling being a basket case, you know, it took someone like Tim Kerrison to come in and say, well, do that, don't do that, do that. And I think there have been a number of little things that Kerrison's done with Wiggins about his training regime that are too complex for me to understand, really. But I think there's been a kind of, and more than that, over and above that, Wiggins buys into Kerrison and he buys into Sutton. And because he's buying into them and they're telling him he's great, he's buying into himself. And with Bradley, as we all know, it's self-belief, isn't it? Because he's this curious mixture of slight mental fragility and monstrous focus.
And he does give good soundbite when he wants to, doesn't he?
Thoughtful boy, isn't he? I mean, he's very articulate. He gets it, you know. He can be absolutely vile as well on occasions, you know, when he wants to. He can be... Some people have said that it's a facet of his shyness and his slight insecurity with people, that sometimes he can be a bit gauche with his put-downs. You know, he's a naturally witty guy. He's a great, as I'm sure you know, impressionist. He can do everybody. I've never heard him do me, but he can do a great Chris Boardman, for example. But because he's kind of good with all that, he sometimes just puts you down. Not just me, but other riders, other journalists, you know, in quite a kind of hurtful way. And it's sometimes a bit unnecessary. You know, we didn't need to have this adversarial moment, Brad. That's a bit inappropriate. It wasn't about that. But he does it sometimes just kind of, it slips off his tongue, and then he has to recover from that. And then next time you'll meet him, he'll be in thoughtful mode and he'll be ever so pleasant and give you plenty of time and some really articulate answers. But, I mean, Mark Cavendish and him, in their two different ways, are complete basket cases, really. You know, they're very interesting, complex characters. And perhaps you need to be a, you know, perhaps that's what Geraint Thomas is missing. You know, he's just a nice guy all round. Ain't going to win much, is he, like that, you know, in his own right, you know.
So let's get back to what it is that you do best on ITV, which is kind of bringing the everyman, the fans' view from the inside of what it's like to be out there in France. And you're going to read a little section from the book. And this is where, do you spend time in the off-season dreaming up these kind of stunts with your production team about what we're going to get Ned to do now? Are we going to get Ned to explain this using the sugar cubes? And then we're going to get Ned to do that.
There is a bit of that goes on. As budgets have got cut down the years, we have less and less time for that. But I mean, yeah, a few years ago, I was sent up the Colombier, I think it's called, in May, the highest mountain pass in Europe, you know, on a bike. That's funny. That'll be funny. Get Ned doing that. You know, there's a lot of that'll be funny to get Ned do that, you know, that sort of thing. And by and large, I kind of, you know, on Thursday, I'll be filming some little vignettes with Chris Boardman on a bike, you know, and he'll be taking the piss out of me, you know, essentially. I'll be riding clumsily behind him and he'll be explaining things in a very simple way about drafting and the lead out and all that kind of... That's the kind of thing they do with me. And this that you've referred to is when they dreamt up the idea, which actually I'd always quite wanted to do anyway, of sending me off with a one-man tent to spend a night with the beery, seething mass of people on the side of a mountain. And we chose one night on the Hautacam in the Pyrenees to do that. And it was interesting. I kind of stumbled around the side of the mountain, going from tent to tent, getting more and more soaked in pastis. And just actually, yeah, so many nationalities there. And it's kind of an extraordinary experience. So watching the convoy of the Tour de France that goes ahead of the race all night to go and set up on the mountaintop, thundering past these great big trucks and everything. And it was, anyone who's done it, and there are plenty of you listening to this, I'm sure, who've actually experienced this, will know exactly what I mean. And if you haven't experienced it, get out and do it, you know?
To the soundtrack of Southeast London emergency vehicles and people having their lunch in this park where we're sitting, you're going to treat us to a night on a bare mountain.
Well, a little bit, yeah. Trudging back up the grassy slope towards my tent, I stopped off one last time, drawn to a scene of painterly beauty. A group of a dozen young Basque students had a campfire roaring, kept burning by a constant supply of aromatic bushwood from their well-organised colleagues on a foraging rota. I asked them if I could join them, and then I concentrated on filming them as they began to sing. I had no idea what songs they were, but they sounded perfect. The alien, ancient language bellowed with throaty sincerity across the bowl of warm light that flickered across their faces. They could have been singing anything. It was wonderful to hear. I suppose they must have asked themselves who I was and what on earth they thought I was doing filming them. But if they did, they hid their suspicions well. I listened for a while longer, politely declined their offer of a swig from their shared bottle of Metaxa, and then headed home to the wilting, dew-speckled accommodation Chris Boardman had sorted for me. I opened my front door with that trademark zipping sound, which more than any other noise evokes the chilly privations of the campsite, and clambered in. Climbing into my sleeping bag and chewing on a salami, I lay awake for a while, enjoying the mixture of sounds outside. The holy trinity of a summer's night on the tour in the High Pyrenees, Basque singing, diesel engines and French laughter. I fell sound asleep and dreamt with frightful intensity that I was in a tent on my own on a mountain. I awoke an hour later to find that I had dissolved into a crumpled heap at the bottom end of the tent. It's one of the great hardships of mountainside camping, a phenomenon that deprives all but the comatose of a decent night's sleep, and I was just about to make its acquaintance. Because mountains rise steadily, there is an entire absence of anywhere flat. Now, this may sound fairly obvious, but until you've felt the resultant effect, you're in no position to judge its seriousness. Forced to sleep with my head higher than my feet, which faced down the mountain, I'd been unaware of what might happen to me. But it's a clear physiological impossibility to gain restful sleep with your calf and thigh muscles gently bracing you against gravity. Eventually, they will simply give in, and you'll wake up to find yourself curled up in a ball at the foot of your tent. Using a baguette as an improvised ice pick, I scaled back up the mountain to the rolled-up ball of jumpers and socks that was making do as a pillow. I lay my head down and closed my eyes again, feeling the gentle insistence of the inevitable crumpling process beginning to take hold even as I drifted off. Outside, it was cold and quiet, the revellers now dotted all across the hillside in their own cocoons, waging their own private wars against the laws of physics. After what seemed like 6 hours and 13 minutes, I gave up pretending to myself that I was sleeping. It was 6:13. I deemed that a respectable enough time to unzip my tent and get going. Coyly, and with the camera self-consciously nosing through the opening to get the shot for real, I blinked into the morning air. Overnight, everything had changed. Still, clear air stood high in the valley and reached from the grass to the stratosphere. Far away, the sun had just burst over the crested ridge of mountaintops that stood guard to the east, making the colours of the various tents on our side glow. It was going to be a beautiful day.
And it is something else to be there. And so, you know, as good as it is to watch it on the TV, It's worth going, isn't it? At least once.
Yeah. I mean, Alpe d'Huez kind of is a bit special, a bit full of Americans for my liking. They kind of think that's the only mountain in France. But and then you get these, you know, it is colossal, the scale of the crowd that goes there. But you get these wildly distorted, exaggerated attempts to guess how many people that the tour organisers put out. You remember when the time trial went up Alpe d'Huez in 2005? They kind of estimated that there'd been 1.5 million people on the side of that mountain. Rubbish. Honestly, what a crap that was. Have you ever seen Wembley Stadium, which holds 90,000, spill out? You know, that looks like 1.5 million people, but it's not. It's 90,000. They are suggesting that somehow there were 20 times Wembley were on out. Nonsense. Rubbish. Look, suffice it to say, there's more people than you ever want to meet in your life on the side of a mountain that day. It's really, really spectacular.
So what are you looking forward to in the next 3.5 weeks?
Evans and Wiggins will mark each other. They're very similar, aren't they? They're the first and second favourite in the race. I'm looking forward to people throwing them, lesser riders, if you like, or riders who can climb with slightly more acceleration and maybe think that's their chance, hurling themselves at the edifice of BMC and Sky in the hope that they can crack them. I think it'll happen, you know. I don't know who the rider's going to be, but someone will go on some lunatic, rampaging, Thomas de Gendt-style thing at some point. Shame de Gendt is on his honeymoon and not on the race, but it'll take someone of his verve to actually, I was going to say panache, but that's an overused word in cycling, but lunacy might be better. Just have a go, you know. That'll be interesting.
Any particular stages that are going to be decisive that people ought to be making a date in their diary for?
Well, the opening week is kind of full of interest again. And I know a lot of Brits are heading over to Bologna for, is it stage three, Jack, or one of their menus? But look at the profiles of those opening that opening week, and it's a little bit lumpier and a little bit, you know, much like it was last year in a sense. Christian Prudhomme's thrown, you know, attacks across the road everywhere, left, right and centre. There's a lot of categorised climbs, albeit fours and threes, quite close to the finish line on a lot of those opening stages, and some ramps to finish on again. So I love all that, you know. I love that, you know, that kind of, those kind of stages that anyone could win, really. Evans won one of them last year, you know.
The tour is getting more interesting on a day by day basis, but it's losing its sense of being a Tour of France, isn't it? Because it's pretty much neglecting the western side of France this time. It's sort of stuck on the eastern side.
Yeah.
Doesn't do that big circle that was traditional. It's become more and more getting like the Giro d'Italia, this kind of sort of slightly convoluted snake.
Yeah, it looks like a kind of cat's been sick all over the map rather than a continuous circle. But I mean, in my 10 years, it's kind of always been a bit like that. West of France gets a bit ignored. A bit boring, though, isn't it? You know, its topography doesn't lend itself to great bike racing. I mean, every time we go through the Vendée, for example, we get terribly excited about crosswinds, and they never happen, you know, which is disappointing. But it's that kind of landscape where you're looking for something. I think Prudhomme likes to mix things up, and I don't know why it's neglected, you know, but I haven't got a problem with it missing out on the West of France too much, because I mean, I do like those stages in the Massif Central that we've had in the last few years, and we're not going there this year, are we? I'm saying that hesitantly because we're not going near it, and I think that's slightly missing from this year's tour. 2016, we'll either start in Yorkshire or Glasgow.
Is that right?
Well, I think it will. I mean, I think that here's a little story for you. Boris Johnson, in his last administration, turned down the opportunity to host the Tour de France. They virtually, Livingstone and Prudhomme had shaken hands on it. And then Livingstone lost the next election. Johnson's regime simply never took up the option to have the Tour de France back to London. Not a grand départ, but a couple of stages. ASO desperately want to come back onto these shores, whether it's Yorkshire or Glasgow, or actually, most realistically, both. What I think will happen in either 16 or 17 is that this is my prognostic view, and it's something to get quite excited about. I think it's going to start in Glasgow without a prologue, and I think in four stages you're going to be in Dover. I think it's going to hurtle top left to bottom right of the country and tick as many boxes as it can, going through Yorkshire on its way.
Wow, that's something brilliant.
Yeah, I mean that's something I just gleaned yesterday up at the National Road Race Championships, talking to the guys at British Cycling. It's not, you know, if Scotland win or Yorkshire win, it won't be a prologue in a couple of stages in Yorkshire or in Scotland. The Tour de France wants to go to Dover. You know, that's how they want to get across to France again. They don't want to get on a ferry at Rosyth or anything. So I think the race will literally go down to the southeast of England eventually. So it'll be a proper kind of national event then, I think.
Wow, that's going to be amazing. When would that get announced?
Oh, I think we're some way off. I mean, what are we now? 2012, a couple of years away. So they, you know, but they don't know if like to plan in advance. And I may have just, you know, that may be rubbish. You may want to play this back and say that was a crap prediction. But I think, as things stand, I think that's the most likely outcome. Chris Froome will win that Tour de France, the 2017 Tour de France. He'll win that. Yeah.
And so finally, the Ned Bolting fan club. I mean, no, the international Ned Bolting fan club.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Oh, you've thrown me a curveball there, haven't you? You want my honest answer? I mean, I suppose I should be flattered, and thank you to everybody who means it in this well-intentioned way, but I think it's massively tongue-in-cheek, and I'm slightly humiliated by it, and I like to imagine that it doesn't exist.
Oh, the felt badges, they definitely exist. I've seen them.
I've had them shown to me too, yeah.
I think you need to make peace with the international Ned Bolting fan club.
I've clearly got issues that I need to resolve. I'd better see a shrink. But it's just, I find it a bit embarrassing, as you can probably tell. Very embarrassing.
I was talking with Ned Bolting. His book, How I Won the Yellow Jumper, is published by Yellow Jersey Press, and it's out now in a new enlarged and revised edition. You can, of course, catch Ned on ITV4 covering the Tour de France, and you can also hear him on the ITV Tour de France podcast, which is a daily podcast, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
thanks for tuning in to The Bike Show. We'll be back again with more on the Tour de France the same time next week. Until then, goodbye.